Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Thank you for joining the Empowerment Zone. I am your host, Ramona Houston. You know, there has been a long history of people of color really working for social change in the U.S., but many times we look at these histories of different communities separately instead of looking at how these communities have worked together and built coalitions and built relationships across races, across cultures in order to bring about social change. So I am so happy today that we are going to have this conversation about the histories of solidarity among communities of color since the 1960s. And we have Dr. Eddie Bonilla with us here today. He is going to talk to us about that history. And I'm so excited to have him. Dr. Eddie Bonilla is currently a postdoctoral fellow in Latinx studies at the University of Pittsburgh. He joined the University of Pittsburgh after having been a postdoctoral associate in ethnic studies at the University of Illinois after receiving his PhD in history from Michigan State University in 2019. He is currently working on his book manuscript, tentatively titled Homegrown Communist in the Age of Reagan, Multiracial Politics and Socialist Revolution. And this manuscript looks at the theories and practices of Latinas, Latino, African-American and Asian-American communists during the 1970s and 1980s. Welcome to the Empowerment Zone, Dr. Bonilla. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, Ramona. I appreciate it.
Well, Dr. Eddie, I'm excited about getting this conversation started. But before we do, can you give our audience a little bit of background about yourself? I'm curious to know your background, where you're from, and also your professional trajectory, how you became interested in studying this particular topic.
Yeah, thank you. I'm born and raised in Southern California in a city called Southgate, which is a predominantly Latino community. And so grew up there. My parents had immigrated from Guatemala around the 1970s. So the child of immigrants, as well as I identify as Central American. And so went to high school, all Latino school, and then eventually made my way to the University of California, Irvine, to do my undergraduate work in Chicano Latino studies. And something I kind of kept asking about in those courses was like, what about other working class peoples, other working class histories? Because I kept feeling like we were focusing on just Chicanos, even though then I couldn't put it into perspective that like, well, duh, we're only focusing on Chicanos because it's a major about Chicanos and Latinos. And so eventually a professor handed me a document that kind of was related to the ideas of Karl Marx and Marxism and kind of talking about class solidarity. And so one thing led to another that I eventually made it to graduate school at Michigan State University to do my PhD work, where I focused in history, but I had a mentor, Pero Dagbovi, who is an African-American historian, who kind of kept pushing me to think about the intersections of, you know, Latino history, African-American history. And so the project kind of developed, and before I knew it, the Chicano Latino organization I was originally writing my dissertation about, I ended up finding out in the archives, looking at documents, that they merged their group with an Asian American group and an African American group. And so at that point, I kind of was like, well, it was really late in the dissertation to do more with it. But now, after completing the dissertation, I'm focused on conducting oral histories and talking with more former activists with African-American and Asian-American backgrounds to get at some of these things, such as Afro-Asian solidarities, Afro-Latino solidarities, as well as Asian-Latino solidarities, all around the kind of lens of Marxism and kind of thinking about how that served as a foundation and as a common language for these activists to begin organizing together. And so that's kind of been my trajectory. And then now in the classroom, I try to bring these similar histories. Even if I'm teaching a Latino history course, we're doing a lot of African American history, a lot of Latin American history, to try to get at these complex topics, because we all live in a world that's not in a vacuum, right? We're all, you know, we have relationships with one another. And so the solidarity angle is one that I've taken for doing this research.
Sounds exciting. You know, so many times when we study these, our histories, we always study them in silos and not really recognizing their interrelatedness and also how they influence each other and how they work with each other. And so tell us about that organization or that you're studying now and how you're putting it in, what lessons are you learning and how are we putting it in context for today? You know, when we see all the issues that are happening today to Black and Brown people, and now Asian Americans have been affected a lot with different issues that are occurring today, particularly the emotional, mental, and physical violence that is going on, that it kind of, it has began to put Asian Americans in this bag with Black and Brown people. And in many respects, they have been seen different as a different type of group and not necessarily coalescing or building relationships with Black and Brown people. But anyway, that's a big, big question. But anyway, I just kind of want to know what about your organization and what you're finding out.
Yeah, so the organization I'm now focusing on is called the League of Revolutionary Struggle, which was formed in 1978, and it dissolves in 1990. But part of what I argue in my work is that, you know, I had to look at them before the organization as well as after. And what I learned is that many of them were involved in campaigns such as anti-police brutality in the San Francisco Bay Area. And this is thinking of Chicano Latinos who were working closely with the Black Panther Party. Another organization known as Iwarkun was the Asian American group that actually merged into the League, as it was commonly referred, which also was organizing. And I use the Black Panthers because I think that's the group that most of us are starting to know more about, particularly with films like Judas and the Black Messiah out there. So Iwarkun ends up joining with another group known as the August 29th Movement, which was again a group that was already organizing with the Panthers. And so there's a lot of this kind of cross-racial solidarities going on. And then there's another big group that joins the League known as the Revolutionary Communist League. But this group was with an African-American base, what came out of the Congress of African People, which was led by the prominent poet and cultural artist and significant political force, Amiri Baraka. But there was others that joined with him. So what ends up happening is you have this multiracial organization that's created, and what they argue for is, you know, they're arguing for socialism and a overall, you know, societal revolution. But what I try to push back on, I think especially thinking about our current context of a lot of anti-communism and anti-socialism that still exists, and I think we have these big words that we don't really kind of get at the personal level and what it means to individuals. And so, as I mentioned, you know, Marxism gave these folks a common political language because each organization was already doing similar readings and similar organizing around different labor strikes, and they were running into each other in different circles. And so I try to argue that they were important intellectuals themselves, whether they were, you know, college educated or not. These individuals were trying to think about, well, what is a Black nation in the United States? What is a Chicano nation in the United States? And what's the role of Asian Americans as well in the US? And so eventually when they create the League, they end up using what's called a United Front, which is this idea of working in organizations like labor unions or working among student organizations on college campuses to fight things like labor exploitation, to fight for affirmative action and for the defense of ethnic studies. And many of these individuals I write about, they were present at San Francisco State University or San Francisco State College at that point that fought for a third world school and for ethnic studies as we now know it. Others were at Berkeley when the free speech movement was going on and movements for ethnic studies there as well. So I try to trace their legacies and through things like higher education, through things like labor as well, because they were organizing among what they called lower stratum workers, meaning kind of those workers that labor unions were forgetting about, cannery workers in the factories, farm workers, as well as auto workers and these kind of heavy industries, as well as hotel and restaurant workers, these kind of these professions that are that had many immigrants, that have many people of color. And so they were trying to help them. Everything as basic as trying to get union contracts translated into multiple languages. And then eventually in the 1980s, they also, along with other left groups, organized for Reverend Jesse Jackson's presidential campaigns in 1984 and 1988. And so I like to say that Reverend Jackson was kind of the Bernie Sanders before Bernie Sanders, because Bernie even endorses him in 1988 because he was fighting for things like healthcare and as well as these labor things. And so what I notice is there's a lot of intersections, and what happens is that you get Latinos learning about Asian American culture and Asian American struggles, as well as African Americans. And one thing I want to note is that the League very much placed the African American struggles at the forefront, because they argued if, you know, African Americans are not free, nobody else could be free. And so seeing how these intersections are tied, as well as trying to think about them in context of, you know, communist history throughout the 20th century that is, you know, sometimes considered primarily white or primarily European or foreign to these communities. But instead, what I'm finding is that these communities use the tools of Marxism to try to reconsider their own local conditions and that their things in their daily lives. And so as far as connecting it to the present, many of these activists are still organizing today, and some of the institutions that they helped to create are still going strong, or many of these individuals founded new organizations. And so there is a lot of multi-generational teaching and learning that these activists are doing, whether it's hitting the streets now for the Black Lives Matter movement or for some of these anti-Asian protests that are going on. They're still out there, as well as being active in other cultural organizations. And so that's sort of kind of the long trajectory, I argue. Even though I'm a historian, I'm still trying to trace these individuals to the present moment, because just because the social movement might end doesn't mean that these people's lived experiences end. Instead, they gain these tools for the next battle, right? Whether it's in the 90s or the 2000s or the present moment.
So the name of the organization is the League of Revolutionary Struggle, correct?
Yes.
And correct. We're calling it the League for short. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us about where they were located? You talked about California. Was it unique to California only, or is it a national organization? And how did they mobilize on the local and national level, if it is a national organization?
Yeah, so it definitely was strongest in California, particularly in places like San Francisco as well. Well, the Bay Area in general and Los Angeles as well, but they did have what they called districts throughout the country. And so they had individuals in the Newark, New York area, particularly after Baraka and the Revolutionary Communist League joins, that was kind of where he was most active. What I argue is that's significant, right? Because you have Amiri Baraka, who's organizing with others in Newark, who then decides to merge with the organization that's predominantly on the West Coast. But then they also would ask, and this is some of the strength, this is some of that personal history I like to get at, is that many of them were asked, you know, would you consider moving to Denver? You know, you lived in California for 21 years, 22 years. Would you move to Denver and organize at a college campus there? Many of them said yes. Would you move to Houston? And so folks also moved to Atlanta. So they were in Atlanta, Houston, New York, Newark area, as well as Chicago a little bit, but their strength definitely was in California. And they also had correspondents in Hawaii, and they were attempting to create a nationwide organization, but definitely the strength was in California.
So what do you see as their many contributions? Because I don't want to say one contribution, because I'm sure that they have laid a foundation for a lot of interesting changes in the US in terms of social change.
I think a few of them that I argue is that they did push some of these more ethnic racial movements, such as whether if we think about the Chicano movement or just even student movements more to the left, to consider, you know, how to think about the big picture of these critiques of capitalism, these critiques of imperialism. But then even then, many of them were some of the first professors in ethnic studies programs. Many of them presently are at some of these big institutions training next generations of historians. So what I try to argue is that even now, even if they don't identify as, you know, Marxists or communists, I think their connection to the past and their past actually influences some of the disciplines in higher education. But then in labor, some of them became union presidents in things such as the California Teachers Association, as well as thinking about how they were organizing in some of these smaller labor strikes where they were union presidents or they were union organizers. And I'll give one example of what was known as Local 2 in the Bay Area, which was the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union. And one thing I should note is that some of these individuals weren't open communists at this point because of fears of police repression, of anti-communism, and, you know, the fact that the Cold War was going on. And, you know, identifying as a communist at this point could make you lose your job. It can really hurt your family. So now that we're 20, 30 years later, many of these folks are starting to be more open and talk about these histories. And so, you know, some of the key leaders in the Local 2 strike in the 1980s were league members who were able to earn better contracts for workers in the hotel restaurant industry, meaning cooks, people who were cleaning rooms, and just these workforces that were, again, predominantly immigrant or people of color. But all the way through, I think even helping sway some of Reverend Jesse Jackson's campaign, some of them were in key leadership positions of the campaign. And it's significant that Reverend Jesse Jackson is one of the is the first candidate to give a speech at San Francisco's Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And so what I argue is that it's not a coincidence, because there are league individuals that are kind of active there. And so sometimes I kind of feel like I might be seen as like this FBI agent that's laying these things out. But I think it's important that we talk about them, because I think that has led to the erasure of some of these people's very important histories. And as I mentioned, many of them are connected actually to the Black Lives Matter movement currently going on in around the St. Louis area. Others have gone on to found organizations such as the Labor Community Strategy Center in Los Angeles, which is an environmental organization that also serves as a think tank, act tank, that is training, you know, young generations of activists. And many are also affiliated with the Chinese Progressive Association, which was started in the 60s and 70s. That is very significant for the Chinese American community as far as culture goes. And so they kind of had their hands in a lot of things. And the question is, you know, how can we measure their actual sway? And sometimes it's very obvious. Other times I think it's kind of in those personal conversations, personal changes to other people's consciousness. So I do think that they helped elevate individuals, what people would call like fellow travelers. So it's a little hard to measure, but that's kind of the way I'm trying to do it.
Yeah, that's what's so valuable and interesting about history, is to find all those connections that are not always obvious to the eye. Reverend Jackson, one person, there were a few people that are close to him that worked on his first campaign. And they told me that they really think that they laid the foundation across the nation for President Barack Obama to be elected, because all of those networks were established. And then you go back even further, like you said, and look at these connections that helped Reverend Jackson, and to really help him in terms of creating a platform that was for workers and pro-labor and just helping marginalized and suppressed groups. So, you know, looking at all that history, what do you think, what have you learned that you, that really intrigued you about learning about all of this history and this organization, the League?
I think first and foremost is that there was challengers on the front lines to the shifts in like neoliberalism, the shifts in the, you know, conservatism. Talking about the League, I had to talk a lot about Ronald Reagan because he did serve as governor, you know, first of California, because California is both kind of a liberal bastion as well as the land of conservatism and of Reagan. And so I think the fact that there was challengers in the 70s and 80s to Reaganism, to neoliberalism, that were trying to keep, you know, industries like the auto industry in California that used to have 10, 15 auto plants. And, you know, even if they identified as communists, they were still locally attuned to these conditions, because what they argued was, you know, if these factories leave, that's going to devastate these communities of color. That's good paying union jobs that are leaving. And, you know, that really shapes the way a community changes. And so one thing I think that's one thing I try to argue for these folks. And then also to just their long distance runners, as Eric Mann kind of theorizes. And Eric Mann was a former League member, and he's the head of the Labor Community Strategy Center. And he's open about being a former League member. But, you know, he leads one of these strikes in GM at a General Motors plant in Van Nuys. And so he calls folks long distance runners. And I think that I really love that, because many of these individuals are still going. They've been in the game for 50, 60 years. But also too, the interpersonal relationships. One thing I like to write about the League is that they advocated for things such as daycares. They created a daycare system where, you know, even if you were married, if you were single, if you were a college student, if you had kids or you didn't have kids, you had to put in your time to take care of the kids. And so, you know, I think that is very important, because many of those kids are still best friends today. Some people baptized others, and just those kind of connections. And there's a lot of, I do tend to kind of favor the solidarity histories. There is some conflicts that arise, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to erase any of that, but just kind of that these folks are still going strong, and they're still either training new organizers, or they're actually themselves getting trained by the younger generations that are trying to teach them about current day conditions. And so that multi-generational teaching and learning, I think, is one thing I would like folks to know about the League.
Wow, this is just fantastic information in terms of the League and really putting them in the historiography about social activism and what's going on today in our various communities. I'm really intrigued with this story, because this is, you know, I've never heard of the League. Not that I'm supposed to know everything, but this just, when you look at the impact that they've made, not only on the West Coast and the East Coast, but the impact they're making in terms of training new scholars and new activists, they really will and are having an imprint and a footprint in social activism today. Is there any other details that you'd like to add about the League and the importance of your work and what you hope to contribute to the historiography?
Yeah, particularly that these folks, kind of back to this point that they were intellectuals, that they need to be treated as folks that were really theorizing their own, you know, histories in the 60s and 70s, right? Before ethnic studies, curriculum was predominantly white. And many would argue we're still kind of, you know, pushing back on some of these old narratives, but, you know, they were writing up their own histories and weaponizing their own histories to try to advocate for political change. And so really just trying to place them into this kind of, I guess I would say, like a pantheon of these Marxist thinkers, right? Like you have your very male-centric, you know, Stalins and Lenins and Mao's and, you know, Fidel Castro's of the world. But the league was led by predominantly Asian American women, which is very significant and very different when you think about communist histories. And just again, pushing back on this notion that, you know, communists are predominantly white or predominant, you know, but and in fact that these individuals really theorized what Marxism meant to them based on their own racialized ethnic experiences. So that's all I really hope to do, is to elevate them into these conversations of these theorists that we already know about, to actually integrate them as well, because they wrote some really prolific theoretical pieces, but also backed it up with practice. And so that's all I really hope folks kind of learn about the league.
And that's one thing that we don't value or undervalue in terms of our study of activists, is really looking at them as intellectuals. You know, they're well-read individuals who really come up, like you said, develop their own theories and add to the existing theories to really explain their experience and try to move the country and the world forward in terms of how they bring about social change.
Absolutely.
So I'm so happy we had you here today. If you could leave our audience with anything that you think that they should do in terms of learning more about the league or really continuing the legacy of the league, what would you recommend to our audience?
I definitely would recommend a few organizations that are still doing the work. And again, some folks don't identify anymore with the kind of ideas of the league, but I already mentioned one, the Labor Community Strategy Center out of, it's in South Central Los Angeles, which again is serving as it's serving to train Black and Latino, Latinx activists to try to kind of argue for getting police out of K-12 education, or arguing for better bus programs to help with pollution and help with environmental activism. But also other groups such as the Organization for Black Struggle out of St. Louis, which has connections to the Black Lives Matter movement. But even then, there's some great organizers there. And overall, I just want folks to kind of keep listening to Black women in particular, but also keep listening to Black activists currently in our present day moment, just thinking about what they're arguing for, right? And these conversations about abolitionism, or these conversations about police brutality, and really taking people for their word and taking people for their lived experiences, because we only know our own personal histories in a lot of ways, but sometimes we that doesn't mean that we can know the every single detail about other people's struggles, even if we are allies and there is allyship and comradeship. But for folks to just really kind of try to take that extra step to listen to these leaders that we currently have.
Thank you so much for those recommendations. If our audience wants to get in touch with you, how would they do so?
Yeah, definitely Twitter is probably the best way. Thinking about I'm at Bonilla, B-O-N-I-L-A, 88 as in the number, and 23. But definitely that's probably the best place. And then a Google search as well, you can find my email and my University of Pittsburgh website by just typing in my full name.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Eddy. And when you finish that manuscript and it's published, you're always welcome to come back and promote your book. And even before then, you're welcome to come back and discuss anything you want to on the Empowerment Zone. We really appreciated you sharing your knowledge with our audience. And we really more so appreciate the great work that you are doing in your scholarship.
Thank you, Ramona. And it was an honor to be on your podcast.
Thank you. Today, we have a Dr. Eddy Bonilla with us today, and he's going to give us a strategy for college success. So, Dr. Eddy, tell us first, what school or schools did you attend? What were your major or majors? And then give us that strategy for students who want to excel in college.
Yeah, so I got my BA at the University of California, Irvine in Chicano Latino Studies with a minor in history eventually. And then I went on to graduate school at Michigan State University to get my PhD in history, with a focus in Latino history, but as well as minors in African-American and Latin American history. And then I have served as a postdoctoral fellow now at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and now I'm currently a postdoc at the University of Pittsburgh.
So what is the strategy that you would give students to make sure that they succeed in college?
I think one of the biggest strategies I would give students is to attend office hours. I know office hours can be, you know, these daunting things. You have to talk to your professor one-on-one, but what I really found is that most professors love what they do and they really love to talk with you one-on-one. And that's where you really get to learn, you know, your professors are just everyday people. Like, I love listening to hip hop and I love, you know, sports. And sometimes I'll talk to students about that more than the actual class itself. And, you know, I only am on the path I'm on because I went to office hours one time and like the professor and the teaching assistant, like, just were so ecstatic to talk to me. And so, you know, if I hadn't done that, and I don't think I did that until my third year of college, because I was, you know, I was afraid to do it. I was a commuter student in undergrad. So I was always like, why am I gonna go to office hours when I can just go home and like hang out? But really, I think taking professors for their open office hours and really talking to them a little bit more, because we love to get to know students on that personal level beyond the classroom.
Great advice. So make sure you visit your professors during their office hours, because those office hours are important for you to build relationships with your professors. And your professors are key to so much in terms of your personal and professional development. So make sure you go see your professors. Thank you so much, Dr. Eddy. Appreciate it.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song, NADWORKS, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.